Take it away, Gary.
Okay, so this is agenda paper 5, which is ICE 28's application of the equity method when an associate's equity changes outside of comprehensive income. And what I'd like to do over the next 10 minutes is just provide a brief summary of the issue and the committee's previous discussions, because I know this one's been going around for a while, so I just think catch everyone up on all the things that have been discussed previously, and briefly explain what we tried to do with the paper structure and the staff analysis, and then summarize the staff recommendation and ask the committee the questions in the paper. So in terms of the summary of the issue to date, in May of 2011, the committee received a request to clarify the accounting in the investor's financial statements when it's got an associate, and that associate enters into a transaction that affects its net assets, but that effect is recognized outside of comprehensive income. So its net assets change, but that effect is not reported in P&L, and it's not reported in OCI. So for example, if you had a situation where you're the investor, your associate issues shares to a third party in the market, not you as the investor, its equity would go up and its assets would go up when it issues those shares. You as the investor have you'll have an increased stake and increased claim on those net assets. How do you record that, or do you record that, was the question. In terms of the history of how we got there in previous meetings, at the May meeting, the committee originally decided to recommend this to the board, because they recommended that the board consider this as part of a broader project to address other issues in IS 28 at the same time. In September, the staff presented the committee's recommendation to the board, but the board asked if the committee would actually reconsider this issue based on the fact that the board was not sure if they were going to get to look at IS 28 in the short or medium term. At the November meeting, the committee then agreed to the board's request. I think the exact words were, we'll take one more crack at this and see if we can help the board out. And then at the January 2012 meeting, the committee considered several fact patterns that illustrated the issue in an attempt to try and develop a principle that the committee could then feed back to the board to try and help them to decide whether or not they wanted to and how they would amend IS 28. In terms of those tentative decisions that have been made to date, so this was at the January meeting, the committee tentatively agreed on the following broad principles, those being that where an investor's share ownership in an associate reduced, either directly, so you directly go out and get rid of it, or indirectly through the associate issuing shares and there being a dilution, that's accounted for as a partial dilution, and that impact should be recorded through P&L. The committee then also tentatively agreed that when your ownership interest as the investor increases in the associate, either directly or indirectly again, the impact of that change should be treated as a partial acquisition, and that will be treated as cost, so no P&L impact. So those are the previous decisions tentatively agreed by the committee. However, there were a couple of fact patterns where the committee were concerned with the implications of that principle, and specifically those were the issue of a written call option by the associate and the equity settled share-based payment by the associate. So the reason for that was with the principle in the January meeting, the staff were proposing that when the associate writes that written call option, the net assets increase on the day you write the call option, which means that the investor would record that gain through P&L because it's linked to a potential dilution. But at a later point in time, when that share option was actually exercised, it would result in a dilution of the investor's holding, which would effectively result in a loss. And I think it was Scott who raised the point to say, but worried about potential structuring opportunities there, because you as the investor can use your influence to get an associate to issue call options for cash. You get to record the gain through P&L. At a later point in time when those options are exercised, you record a dilution loss through P&L. So that was one of the concerns. The concern relating to the equity settled share-based payments was because we said applying the principle at the January meeting, in an equity settled share-based payment, your associate's net assets don't actually change while it's over the vesting period. So over the vesting period, the associate's going debit expense, credit equity, which results in no net asset change. So we said applying that principle at the investor level would mean that you would record no impact for the share-based payments until that dilution actually occurred. So once the shares are vested and the employees exercise, you'll get the dilution loss coming through the investor's accounts, but but until that time, the share-based payment would effectively be invisible in the investors' accounts. And I think there were some concerns from the committee with respect to that fact pattern as well. So to address that, the committee said, asked us to go away and have a look at those two fact patterns and see if we could come up with something else that might result in an accounting answer that maybe made a bit more sense or that was the committee could get a bit more comfortable with. So the paper is split into two fact patterns, which are in Appendix A. The first pattern is where an associate issues a call option in exchange for an item of PP&E. And the second example is where the associate enters into a equity-settled share-based payment with its employees for employee services. In terms of summary of the analysis and the results from looking at those examples, we think that the key difference with a written call option that isn't net settled is that it effectively splits your dilution gain or loss into its two constituent transactions. That's the problem. So for example, when the associate issues shares, so not options, when the associate goes out and issues shares to a third party, I think everyone is comfortable with the analysis then because we said, well, the investor can compare what they got, so what's their share of the cash that comes in, to what they lost, which is the dilution, how much of that associate carrying that balance they lose. So we're okay in that case. But with a written call option, it splits that transaction into two pieces that happen at different times. So you only get the good news when you write the call option because your net assets go up at that point in time. The net assets go up and your share of the net assets as the investor go up at that point in time. And then there'll only be some later time in the future if that option is exercised that you'll get the dilution effect coming through. So the problem is because it splits it into two pieces, that's why I think the committee had concerns with recording that P&L, that P&L gain and loss. You don't show them at the same time. They might be in different periods. So in order to best reflect that transaction, that's what we proposed now in the paper, and I think it's summarized in the table in paragraph 12. And what we tried to do as well is apply that same logic to the PPE example as to the share-based payment example. So we said in order to maybe reflect this transaction better than we did previously at the January meeting, the answer is to maybe say what you should do is record your change in the net assets, but follow the recognition of that change in the same way that the associate is. So in other words, you will record it through equity. So for a written call option, you record your change in the net assets, but you record it through equity. And you have to remember, though, that you recorded it through equity so that if at a later point in time you do have that dilution loss, you remember to take into account that good news, otherwise it being punitive to the investor. They don't get to record the fact that they actually got something in or they had an increase in net assets when that call option was issued first. So that's kind of how we analyze the transactions to get to an answer that we think makes more sense and is a better reflection of the accounting. So if you try and put that into principles and you combine it with the decisions from the January meeting, the principles that we think the committee could apply would be, as I mentioned before, if you've got indirect or direct disposals, that goes through P&L. That's a disposal through P&L. If you have indirect or direct acquisitions, that's recorded at cost, no impact. And then the results from this paper, if you have a transaction with, the associate has a transaction that isn't one of those two types of transactions, the investor will follow the associate's accounting and put that credit into equity, but they need to remember that in case it's a written call option and take that into account when they calculate their gain or loss. It's almost as if we've got to a point where the accounting looks a bit better, but the application is a lot more complicated to get there. If I could kind of sum up where we were before in January to where we are now. Those principles that I've just run through are summarized in paragraph 15 of the paper. And in terms of our recommendation, that's set out in paragraph 18 of the paper. And our recommendation would be that, we think the committee should, we recommend that the committee update the board on the committee's latest thinking and their decision to address the question the board originally asked, which was help us as the board to decide whether and how we should amend IAS 28. So we think the committee is hopefully in a position following this meeting to do that, so that would be our recommendation. So our questions for the committee: does the committee agree with the principles in paragraph 15 of the paper? And does the committee agree with the staff recommendation to present the committee's recommendations to the board as explained in paragraph 18 of the paper?
Comments? Joanna?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you agree. Okay. Laurence?
I got three questions. The first one is this equity entry that you have, which is temporary, where you have a recognition of an increase in equity, so sending a message to users that you have increased your wealth in the entity. So I suppose it's increase of group's equity, of the parents' equity. What type of equity? Will it be retained earnings? Will it be?
Well, something outside of comprehensive income.
Something outside. Equity, and so yeah. You can choose and decide where you want to put it.
Well, I think, yeah.
Okay. So it's quite innovative to explain that you have an increase in wealth, but it would seem to me important that we also send a signal to users to say, hey, I'm recognizing an increase in wealth now, but be careful, because this is likely to be followed by a decrease in wealth when you will have a dilution. So while I can understand where you are heading to, I can agree, I think that for the users, it would be extremely helpful to understand that this might just be a temporary increase in wealth, because it is going to be followed up by a decrease in wealth when the options are exercised. And my other comment is, you have not addressed the case where the options are not exercised. So what would happen when the options are not exercised?
And just a question there. Are you proposing, Laurence, that we would have a separate category in equity for this to make it clear that it might be something that comes back, or how?
I don't know. I'm asking the user around the table how they would like.
It's a funny.
What's the most useful?
It's a funny notion of equity, isn't it? It's not paid in capital. It's not retained earnings. It's over. Ruth, Andrew, and Luca, I think I had.
I'm okay with where the staff has got to. I agree with Laurence's concern about A, what if the options aren't exercised, and B, how do you flag that this. I'm happy with any bucket of equity. You know, the share of net assets has increased. It's not anything else, so I don't mind what we call it, as long as it's equity of some sort. So I'm okay with where we've got to, and I think it fits with equity accounting, which is what we asked you to do. But I have a bigger concern, which is that if you look at the proposals overall, what you've developed in prior papers and these, I think we've created something that is very complicated. I don't disagree with where you've got to. I think it is one approach to the problem. But we've come up with something so complicated, and I'm not sure it's really going to be that useful in practice. And I wonder whether we serve any purpose by trying to address it. I think this is one way. We could say to the board, here's a way to do it. It's really complicated. What sort of lifespan would it have within the equity accounting standard? Those are the sorts of concerns I have. But I would be happy to present it to the board with those sorts of caveats on it.
So you're, just to be certain I understand your view, you would be satisfied to articulate the general principle,
yeah,
and just set these two aside and say we don't want to go into these.
Into any of these? Any of these things, dilution, gains, losses, all of that stuff. I will just leave it. But I think that's one of the options we should present the board with, is to say, here is a, you know, we've done a lot of thinking on this. This is a way to proceed. Another way to proceed is to do nothing,
okay,
which is less complicated.
On any of
on them. Anything, okay. On any of them.
Let's see, Andrew. Well,
of the five views set out in the staff paper, I agree that view D is probably the best, but I do have, I suppose, two issues with it. I mean, first of all, you've got something in group equity that relates to an associate, whereas the associate's not part of the group, which is kind of the point that Laurence was making. And secondly, at the end, when the actual transaction happens, you are, despite what the paper says, you are recycling from equity to P&L, which you could say is a more extreme form of recycling than recycling from OCI. So, you know, the way I was looking at it is if you've got an associate and you've got a 30%, somebody owns 30% of the shares, another party owns 70%, and you've obviously accounted for your 30%, and that associate issues preference shares. So the associate goes debit, cash, credit, new investor, preference shares. You don't do anything. Your 30% investor doesn't do any accounting at that point in time on day one, because you've just added a new slice of equity to the associate that belongs to somebody else. So I don't think you do anything on day one there. So I ask myself, why do you do anything on day one in this case? You've issued an option or whatever. Okay, it's not the same as preference shares, but it is an equity instrument to another investor, and that's got economic value. So I don't see why you do any accounting on day one. During the life of the thing, you pick up your share of share-based payment expense, you pick up your share of plant depreciation, and then you account for the dilution as and when it happens at the end of the day.
I think maybe the difference would be in my mind that the share option is linked to a potential dilution. I think one of the principles the committee was coming to at the January meeting was that dilution gains and losses, when they occur, need to go through P&L. So your pressure one, you're never going to be diluted. There's never going to be a change in your ownership interest.
You will be diluted when the option's actually exercised, depending on the exercise price and its reference to net asset value. You will get dilution, but you don't get it till the end.
With your pressure example.
No, what are you saying with the option?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's maybe why we see the call options as being different from the pref shares. Because the call options is going to result in a dilution to you. Your pref shares never will.
No, I know, but I was illustrating the pref shares to say that's a slug of equity that belongs to somebody else. And assuming on day one that the equity option is a fair value transaction, then that slug of equity belongs to somebody else just in the same way as a preference share does, and you don't do any day one accounting.
I think Andrew's point, if I understand it, is if it were a convertible pref, you'd have, his argument would be that you wouldn't create any dilution until the conversion actually took place. So there's no need to hang up a number in equity.
Correct. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Which is certainly a more elegant solution. I've got Luca, Charlotte, and then Laurence.
I share the same concern on Laurence and Ruth, especially for the complex approach that came out from the analysis, that is absolutely correct from a technical point of view, but it's very difficult to apply, especially I think that we have also to consider that there are a lot of information that you need to apply this kind of treatment that confirm that the equity method is really similar to a synthetic consolidation, so you need a lot of information flow to produce this kind of accounting, and generally it is not easy not only to obtain, but to obtain in a time lag that is consistent with your preparation of financial statements. So the analysis from technical point of view, it's my opinion, absolutely correct, but probably we should also think about a fallback considering that we are responding to an item that we have proposed to be analyzed by the board, because we think that a more general review of EAS 28 is necessary. So I don't think that if we also add a fallback to say this is the correct analysis, but we can also find a short-term solution for this kind of element that is more easy, thinking about the complete review of the standards in a future period.
Charlotte?
I think I had similar points. I thought I understood why the staff got to a decision, but it relied on you having quite a lot of information about what was going on in your associate in order to be able to basically strip out a lot of the associate's accounting to restate your own. I also had the question, I couldn't see which of the examples would give the better result in the event that the options lapsed or weren't exercised, and I would like to see that.
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I think that probably just an oversight in the paper, but I think the way the paper's written, it would have probably said if you didn't end up with a dilution that credit and equity would stay within equity, because it would never, and that I suppose, if we can use the time now, I just ask the committee, do they think that that's the right answer, or do they think that if it lapses, it should flow back through P&L, because if it does, then maybe the argument to record it through OCI is actually a better argument. Because if you are going to recycle it, regardless of whether or not there's this dilution, then maybe OCI is the better answer. No.
I've got a light at the board member corner there, which Philippe?
I'm a simple man, and I want to be able to explain these kind of transactions and the accounting to a layman. Okay, I have 20% in an associate. This associate is issuing, example 2, share options to the employees. There is a risk that I will be diluted if the options are exercised at a price which is less than the fair value. It's a risk. But as long as they are not exercised, what happens? Debit, P&L, credit, equity in the associate. My total equity doesn't change. My 20% of that equity doesn't change until the point where I am diluted. And then I have a gain or loss on dilution. Why should I record a debit investment in equity on investment in associate and credit equity during that period of time until the dilution takes place? What I am trying to depict by this debit on credit, where do I have an increase in my equity as an investor in that associate? I just can't get to it.
Well, that was where what we were proposing in the January meeting, where we were saying there should be a zero impact until the dilution. But I think that if you look at the way I think that we explained view D in the paper, it's to say that if you break the share-based payments up into what it represents, it actually represents the fact that on day one, you as the associate have got this asset. You got that asset by issuing equity. That's the right for employees to provide services. Then the next day you use that asset up and they provide the services and it goes through as an expense through the P&L. But if you don't record something in the investor's accounts, you don't record the fact that by issuing that equity you actually received some form of asset. So we were trying to draw the analogy between that and the PPE example, where it's clear that you got an asset. And in that case we're saying, well, then there should be an increase in the investor's stake. So that's difficult to explain to a layman, but I think that's...
I'm talking about example 2, it's
a
share payment.
Yeah.
Example 1. Example 1, yes, I got a new asset, and someone has put it into the company. But example 2, I don't have anything new. I mean, the equity is unchanged.
I think if in example 1, if you took that PP&E and you used it all up the minute you got it, we would get to the same answer that we've got to with the share-based payments.
Okay, but I don't understand how you get from there to example 2, where you say you should have a debit in investment and credit equity, for example 2. Can you rationalize for me what happens to me as an investor? My 20% is unchanged until the dilution happens. My underlying equity is unchanged. And suddenly I have an increase in my investment and credit equity.
If we don't do anything in the question that Lee's asking about, we're actually going to pick up 20% of the expense, right? I mean, if we just
If we don't think further about it,
correct, yes, you'll get a double.
You're going to pick up 20% of the expense because it's going to flow through your kind of normal equity method pickup, and I think that's kind of what we're trying to deal with. We're going to pick up 20% of the expense in the ordinary course. Do we want to do something to recognize the fact that there were no assets expended by the investee in exchange for that expense that we picked up a piece of?
Well, it depends how you do the equity accounting. If you do a form of proportionate consolidation, taking at 20% of net income, 20% of OCI, 20% of other changes in equity, yes, you have to reverse your debit to your P&L, your 20% is your expense. You have to offset it. But if you do equity accounting by taking the variations in the equity of the investee, except transactions between investor and associate, then I don't have to do it. I don't have to do it then.
I don't think we have the option of doing it that way, do we?
And then you have to explain clearly here that it is only to offset the 20% expense that you have recognized through picking up your share in net income or net loss of the investment.
The proportionate consolidation.
Tricia?
I just wanted to express a view on Gary asking whether we thought OCI was the right place to take it. And I don't think the committee should probably think too long about that, because I don't think the board would think too long about that. We're in the middle of the agenda consultation, and one of the things that we've heard consistently throughout that consultation is that the board should address what OCI is and the difference between P&L and OCI. So I think this would not be an opportune time to start adding things that go through OCI. And it's always very controversial when the board itself proposes to take things through OCI. So I don't think it would be the best solution. That's my personal view.
You down as undecided. Hey,
I just want to make a comment from perspective of a preparer. It looks like it's too complicated to in practice to follow that, because especially for the for some associates with the entity may not have the sufficient inference to get those information to do that.
Laurence, Scott, were you wanting to get back in at some point?
Yes, but no.
Okay. And then Jean. Sorry, push the button.
Initially, I was not in the view D camp. I particularly when looking at share-based payments, I was in the view E camp, which I think is what Philippe has just expressed. That is, you pick up your share in P&L when you recognize the share-based payment expense, and then you account for the dilution when it takes place. But as you rightly explained so in the paper, this results in double counting of the expense. So I excluded that one. Then I said, okay, if I want to avoid the double counting, then this means I must go to view A. That is, I don't recognize my share of the share-based expense. I just recognize the dilution. But I don't like that answer either. So I don't like the OCI answer either. So this is where I thought to myself, and particularly considering your demonstration with the asset case, that the view D was the most appropriate answer. What convinced me, particularly with the asset case, is that, indeed, when you receive PP&E at the beginning, as an associate, you have a share in that PP&E. So it is appropriate to recognize an increase in wealth at that time. So I'm not offended that there is a recognition of an increase in wealth. In the same way as for share-based payments, if you pick up your share of the share-based payment expense, still, there is no increase in the wealth from the associate overall. So your share in the associate should not decrease. And, but if you just recognize the entry for your share of the share less expense, automatically your share in the associate will have decreased. So this is why I ended up telling to myself, well, perhaps the VUD is the most reasonable one. I know it's a little bit complicated, but if well explained, it's not that complicated. On the contrary, practically speaking, I think it will ease on equity accounting, because this will help reconciling your share of the associate's equity. So I see merits in that approach, with the caveat as explained, the disclosures, perhaps thinking of the line item and options that lapse.
Scott?
I just agree, and actually I think it was good that Laurence preceded me, because I think my thinking followed some of the same logic. I didn't think we could not pick up the investor's share of the expense, because IAS 28 says you have to. And so if we're picking up the expense and not doing anything for equity, we have a problem. And so then when I follow through everything else, I come to view D as the best answer. It is complicated. I think the easiest thing would be to say ignore it, and then you're just going to pick up your 20% of the expense and move on with life. But I think that doesn't reflect what's really going on. With regards to the issue Charlotte mentioned, that, you know, this kind of presumes that you know a lot about what the investee is doing in order to do this correctly, I think that's true, but IFRS already presumes you know a lot about the investee's accounting. If the investee uses different accounting policies than you do, you have to change them. You have to know every accounting policy that your investee is doing in order to faithfully apply that part of IAS 28. Now, I might question whether you ever actually know that, but I mean, the presumption that you know a lot is already in there. We're not adding it. So, for better or for worse, I think if we're going to resolve this, view D is the way to go. And if the board, you know, I mean, this is a suggestion to the board, and if it's too complex, then we won't do it.
John?
Yeah, when I look at the principle, principle seems to be right. When I look at the application example one, though, I had some concern, and I think it's back to Lawrence's concern initially. For sure, I'm trying to assess the economic position of the investee and the investor in the investee. And for sure, initially, when the options are issued at a strike price of zero, my initial reaction is to say, well, that's pretty much equivalent to issuing shares. Shares with their restriction and resale for whatever the number of years until the exercise of the options. So I was a bit troubled with increase in wealth while I know for sure that I'm going to be diluted, because exercise of the option is certain, right, at zero. So it's like we're taking bits and parcels and we're trying to account for it, as opposed to what's the overall picture of this particular set of circumstances. So that's why I think that if we one option could be to book the dilution gain up front, as if they are equivalent to shares. But maybe in the accounting literature we cannot do that. If not, then I would say that booking an increase in my equity upon issuance of the option is certainly not reflective of the economic of my transaction as an investor. So I have trouble with the increase in the equity upon issuance of the options. I think we have no choice but to record the expense going forward, and then recording the dilution gain at the end or upfront, because exercise is certain. So anyway, my point, I guess, here is we should select an accounting method that is not too complex, but also reflects the economics of the investor. And I think that we should not increase the equity of the investor upon issuance of the option in this particular set of circumstances, for sure. It becomes more difficult if you have an exercise for the option, say for the example two, where you issue option to employees. Usually you have an exercise price, so you don't know whether there will be exercised or not. But nevertheless, I think we should stick to what's the economic of the transaction initially. And then I also want to support the views that we should also address what happens if the options are not exercised. Of course, with these examples, this cannot be the case. But an example with an option that has an exercise price would be welcome.
Andrew.
Well, I still don't think that on day one your share of the net assets changes. Your slice of the pie hasn't changed. And it seems odd to me that on day one we do some accounting which effectively anticipates dilution. And in terms of double count of expenses, we shouldn't forget that as a result of the employee expense or as a result of the plant depreciation, the investor is getting, in theory, an increased share of revenues and profits generated by that expense. But anyway, if this is all too complicated, and I personally wouldn't vote for any of the five views set out here, then it kind of seems a bit of a shame to abandon all the principles that we've talked about. I mean, the first two, the dilution and the addition, seem to be fairly uncontroversial. So it would be a shame to lose those if we're going to abandon it due to complexity.
Guido and then Joanna.
I understand that the accounting that we propose here in D is complicated, and I was first firmly in the camp of D. Now, listening to what has been said about has the economic situation of the investor really changed, I would like to come back to something that I mentioned the last time, which a lot of people laughed about, which was this good old culmination of earnings process. I would say that if, and that's an assumption, if the company issues shares either to employees or to third party and gets something, either PP&E or work exchange, then my assumption is that's at fair value. So my economic position doesn't really change. As an investor, it doesn't really change because I'm getting something back that has the same value. I'm having less of a larger cake, but what I'm having looked at in fair value, it's still the same. Now we have a problem because at equity accounting is not a fair value accounting. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. And the question is, when do I realize that difference between the fair value and the book value? In this case, in the examples here, it's surprisingly a loss. So, but that may be. You can come up with equity accounting which is more than fair value because value in use might be higher than the fair value. So you would not impair. So my proposal would be that as long as it's a fair value exchange, nothing happens at the beginning. If you're getting more than fair value, then you have a gain. If you're getting less, then it's a loss. But if it's at fair value, nothing happens. And then only if you really exercise, if the option is exercised, no, maybe not even then. Not even then you would show anything because the combination of the earnings process, so the difference between the book value and the fair value only realizes when you are actually directly selling a percentage. Because then you're selling 3% of your equity investment, you're getting back cash. That's the realization, mm-hmm. my point of view, which would bring us back to the consensus we had before. We would not stick with the consensus
exactly.
anymore.
Yeah.
you would say for indirect disposals, you would not recognize any gain or losses, only if it's not
if it was a fair valued report.
And I would not be concerned with recognizing the expense for the asset that has been contributed. It's either the work or the PP&E, because I mean that's it's used in the production process. It makes sense that I have the expense in there. And I would have the same problem if the associate would take 1,000 cash, acquire a machine, and the machine would be depreciated over time. You could also say at the beginning, nothing has changed really for me as the investor, but then you're using up the machine in order to produce revenues, which also get back to me. So I wouldn't have a problem with double counting for expense. I don't see that.
So your view, let me see if I understand. Your view would be in the case of the employee share option. That I would do, well, when the option is issued.
If it's at fair value, I wouldn't do anything. Not at the exercise of the option, not at the beginning. I would just recognize the expense because I'm using up workforce, and that's it.
But that would, that implies that, okay, let me drop back down. You would recognize the P&L effect of having issued the share-based payment, not because it's share-based payment, but because it's consumption of an asset.
Right.
And then, if the option is exercised, 99 times out of 100, that's because it's in the money. So you are being diluted. You're saying you would recognize an expense or you would not recognize
it? It's not at fair value. So if the thing that I got is less than the fair value of the dilution, then I would recognize a loss.
So you're going to do a kind of exercise date accounting for the dilution that you suffer as an investor because it was exercised.
I'm not sure about exercise data. I would have to think about that again, but it's grant date because what I've received actually from the employee was, let's say, 500 worth of the work that I've used. If the shares that the employees get afterwards are 600 worth, then I would recognize 100 loss.
100 of expense, yeah. It's not true exercise date accounting because you're not going to do anything in between.
Right.
But you are going to recognize the effect of the dilution on exercise.
It's probably more
based on fair value.
Yes.
Based on
you're looking at the fair value of the services plus the exercise price,
right,
compared to the fair value of the share at exercise
date.
Well, that's
but you're going
to at grant date for the equity settlement. But
you're going to exercise. You have two pieces.
But if we do it, I mean, I follow that. But if we do it at grant date and we issue and the investor issue.
Investee issues the most common form of option with a strike price equal to market at grant date, then when you add up the fair value of the services, which are Black-Scholes value, plus the exercise price, you're going to get an amount greater than the fair value of the share.
Which is a gain in this.
So then you have a gain.
Yes. If the fair value what I'm getting is more than the fair value of what I'm giving up, then I would say that's a gain already. But only if, you know, I would compare fair values because that's really changing my economic position as an investor. It's not about the, you know, what's the difference between the book value, the investment equity book value, and the fair value. I don't know whether that's a simpler approach to what we have right now. But
yeah, I think, can we bring ourselves back? The standard that we're dealing with here, the revised IAS 28, trying to recall exactly what it says. Does it say we have to recognize all changes?
Well, that was the problem, is that the definition of the equity method says you record your change in the net assets. And the problem is that when we amended, and that was the problem, is that when we amended 28, we took out the bit that said you just follow what your, because we didn't used to have the split between OCI and equity. So we just said if it's in P&L, put it in P&L. If it goes to equity, you put it in equity. And it's when we made the consequential amendment, we said, if it's in P&L, put it in your P&L. If it's in OCR, put it in your CNR, and we didn't say what to do with everything else that goes directly.
But it did say we have to recognize it.
Well, in the definition of the equity method, it's still there. Right. So paragraph 2 still says you recognize your change in the net assets.
I think in Dino's suggestion, which frankly I don't mind, if we invested at $8 a share, and that's what our investment is on the books for, and then the investee goes out and sells stock at $15 a share because that's the current market price when it sells it, I think Guido would have us recognize nothing because fair value-wise, we didn't gain or lose anything. But I think the standard doesn't let us do that.
Yeah, but that's a problem because here we apply something like fair value. I acquired something for 8. Now the shares are sold for 15. Now the shares are sold for 15. I'm saying, oh, I realized a gain, which is kind of fair value accounting. I would say you can realize a gain of 7 if you sell your shares that you have acquired for 8.
Yeah.
That's combination of
so you would have different accounting for directed versus indirect.
That's right.
We can do that. I think US GAAP actually does that for certain of these situations. I just didn't think IAS 28 would let us do that.
No, but I think the mandate that we've got from the board is to effectively come back and help them develop the principles. So I think we kind of got delegated work from the board as opposed to interpreting what 28 says at the moment is the way I understood.
So can we change it? So
we could change it if we wanted to.
Joanna,
well, we could propose to change it.
Joanna, Ruth, Andrew, and then let's see if we can call this to an end.
Wayne, I started off this by just saying yes.
I have noted
all over the place. I thought it was nice and simple. Having listened to all of the discussion, I do wonder whether, and Gary has sort of hit on it on where we've got to in terms of the board asked us as to whether we could come up with something that was a short-term solution in relation to IAS 28. I think the principles that, and we are now focusing on one particular area, which yes, we said we wanted to at this meeting from last time, but incredibly complex, and as Ruth said half an hour ago, do we really want to say to the board to put this in? And I mean, I think it's actually got even more complex. It's obviously a really difficult area. I actually asked the question, as Scott said, in the old IAS 28, it said, if you put it in P&L, put it in P&L, and if you put it in equity, put it in, if you're, so the issue arose, existed then around share-based payments, so why is it suddenly new? And well, I don't know whether there are practically any major examples or issues around this as to why we're spending so long on it. I just wonder whether we can simply recommend to the board or say, yes, we have re-deliberated it. The first two, the ones we talked about in January, were absolutely key principles, and we'd encourage that. The others we think there are some real difficulties with. Not sure how the board want to deal with it, but try to articulate some of the difficulties and effectively leave it. I think then we have done our job. I don't believe it, quite frankly, it is appropriate to recommend Guido's solution, albeit to the board, because it's so damn complicated. And as you said, to practically try to apply any of this, it's really, really hard. I mean, we are supposed to be helping people, not making it harder.
Okay. Andrew, and then Ruth for a wrap-up.
Well, sir, I understand what Guido's saying, and in a fair value world, it makes perfect sense. But, I mean, I guess we're not in a fair value world when it comes to equity accounting, so what we got to compare with is book values to exercise prices, and whilst I understand the fair value argument, I would just deal with it on that basis.
Ruth?
I was going to make a similar point about Guido's suggestion, because I think that fair value model is a different model from the equity accounting model. So I don't see how it fits. I can see how view D fits a bit better with the equity accounting model. And I think what we've struck is the complexities of share-based payment accounting in particular, and how complex that is. And then we've overlaid that with then how does that flow up from an associate to an investor when the associate isn't actually consolidated. So we've got all these layers of complexity, and UD seems to be a way to deal with it. I would still, if we were going to recommend anything to the board, I would still go with UD. But I think we should highlight those complexities and possibly say, yeah, on the first two issues, we think that could be reasonably easily dealt with. But on this last one, it's the complexity of the accounting itself that's causing us the problem in rolling it up to the top level.
It's not the complexity of the transaction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So.
Okay, Laurence, last call.
I was wondering whether when we say just follow up what the associates did, so just pick up the share in equity, what it would resemble like in the views you have outlined. Isn't it similar to what you have in view? Wouldn't we end up with what you have in view C, in effect, for share-based payments? That is, in effect, you recognize debit income from an associate for your share of the investment for share-based payment to equity. And then when you have dilution, you just go to the dilution. That is, you don't have that recycling of the piece that has been put into equity. That's the only difference with the view D, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad David Tweedy never heard this argument. He would have said that this is the single best illustration of why we should never have equity accounting in the first place.
I thought he was going to say the single best illustration of why we should never have IFRIC.
I'm not sure. Let me try. I guess if I were to say which view got the most positive comment, it would be view D, but not with a very great degree of enthusiasm. I heard a couple of people justifying it as the least bad argument. And I have to admit I'm troubled by the idea of creating a new category of equity that isn't paid in, isn't retained earnings, and isn't OCI. I was raised to salute the flag and respect the all-inclusive income statement. So I'm troubled by that. It does seem to me that we could improve the quality of the guidance and the state of practice if we never talked about these two issues, which is essentially saying, okay, we explored these and we decided they're number one, especially the call option, probably limited in application. The share-based payment, not so much, but the call option. And we can address, you know, it's an 80-20 issue. We can deal with 80% of the problem by dealing with the stuff that we discussed last time and inform the board of the difficulties that we had when we got into these two particular transactions. But I'm hearing that at least that there's the genesis of a proposal that we suggest to the board that they not go there, that they stop with the stuff that we talked about last time around. Do I see support for that as a recommendation to the board?
So you mean they deal with the things we
dealt with last time? Right, yeah. But not with these two crazies.
Was it specifically on any specific issue?
Gave three examples that we then added more when we asked the movements. Is for example, share-based payments, gains and loss in associates, transactions with non-controlling interests and liabilities recognized as better put options with non-controlling interests. So I think we've got it. Yeah, so they
didn't care about it.
They were asking about share-based payments as well. But I think, again, it was one of the examples that they had of the net asset changes. It wasn't specifically on this one, but they said there's a whole lot of things. For example, I mean, their original proposal was that it should all go through P&L, which means you would ignore the share-based payments. So,
okay, I see general support for going to the board on that basis. And hopefully this never coming back to us again. Or I hope it never comes back again. And David, if you're listening in, the point has been demonstrated for you. So. Why don't we take a break? I think we have one scheduled now. Come back at 10:02.